Blog Talk Radio.
From deepest, darkest Africa, across the polar ice cap, spanning the jungles of South America, without a compass, without a map, Blog Talk Radio and Wildlife Educational Services presents Larry Batson's Wild World. Discover the wonders of the natural world with nationally known wildlife educator Larry Batson as we visit his wild world.
Well, happy 4th of July, everyone, from our animal compound in Clinton Falls, Indiana. This is Larry Batson, and you are listening to Wild World on this magical network we call Blog Talk Radio, as we say hello to our listeners around the world, Australia, New Zealand, Ireland, England, across North America, and even the small community of Monrovia, Indiana. It's great to have you along. We would also like to thank Scott Carney for putting our music together tonight. We're very excited about our guest. And as always, from the Wild World News Studios in Indianapolis, Indiana, now HD, newly renovated, the honorable, distinguished, and always punctual, Dr. Henry Day. Good evening, Doctor.
Good evening, Mr. Batson. The weather has cooled off here in Indiana.
It has.
We're enjoying 68 degrees tonight.
Well, our guest tonight, Rick Roberts from such great bands as the Flying Burrito Brothers and Firefall, which we all remember so well. He lives in Colorado, so this, to me, reminded me of a Colorado evening. As they say, the temperatures are going to be in the 50s, so that's a big change from what we've been dealing
God's
with.
God's country. Rick, where are you in Colorado?
I'm in Longmont, about 10 miles to the northeast of Boulder.
Oh,
God, I've lived in Boulder for a long time, but the price of living there got completely out of hand. So all of us old Boulderites kind of moved to the satellite towns.
My family has a cabin down near La Vida, Colorado, about 80 miles south of Pueblo.
That's way down south, yeah.
Well, Dr. Day, I feel a road trip to Colorado.
Oh, yeah.
You don't have to say that twice to me. You know how I feel about Colorado.
Yes, God's country, as you call it.
It's God's country. This part of Wild World is brought to you by Bigfoot. It ruined my whole train of thought. Weekend and Expo. It's available on DVD. Oh, excuse me. Available online on demand for just $4.99 if you're fans of such shows as Not Finding Bigfoot and Sasquatch Legend Meets Science. And all the other shows they've had on Discovery Channel. Go to ChautauquaLakeBigfoot.com. Let me spell that for you. Right, get your pencils, folks. ChautauquaLakeBigfoot.com. Over 6 hours of video from such great experts, and I use the word term loosely, Billy Willard, Melissa Hovey, Steve Calls, yours truly, and the infamous Bob Gimlin of the Patterson-Gimlin film. It's all there, available at ChautauquaLakeBigfoot.com. Great deal, only $4.99. They make it possible for Wild World to be on Blog Talk Radio.
It's now time from his broadcasting mecca in Indianapolis, Indiana, the distinguished Dr. Henry Day with the Wild World News.
Good evening. This is Dr. Henry Day with the Wild World News for July 3rd. We are on the eve of the 4th.
We are.
And I already hear fireworks going off through the neighborhood.
Oh, I've said enough about them damn fireworks.
Yeah, well, you live out far enough where they shouldn't be too bothered by them.
Oh, they sound like mortar shells, Dr. Day.
How
sounds
do the
like
tigers
a Vietnam War.
Handle it?
Oh, the tigers and bears and stuff, they handle it fine. It just makes Cheryl and I so angry.
I can understand that. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the way we feel around here, too.
Yeah, boom,
then
boom.
Then tomorrow, you know, in the evening when it gets dark enough, they start firing off. It scares the birds. It scares all the animals. And it's just a total mess. But it is exciting, and it's a tradition, so.
Yeah, but go watch the pro show. Don't watch the amateur hours. And you know what someone pointed out to me? I hate to be easing up this time. But the soldiers, the ones back from combat, really don't appreciate the fireworks because it reminds them of when they were in war.
That's right.
So, you know, think about that, folks.
Yeah, that's right. All right. Well, I hate to report this, but there's no monster in Taunton, Massachusetts.
Damn.
Yeah, the creature spotted swimming in the Taunton River this month has been confirmed as a beluga whale.
Oh.
The lone whale has been seen at various points as far inland as Dighton.
Well.
Yeah, too bad. So it's a whale. It's not some type of sea monster.
Well, there's about 50 hillbillies turning around their Winnebagoes.
Yep.
Look for the sea monster.
They're not going to believe us anyway, so they're still going to be looking for it.
Hell, probably.
Well, now, this is how serious the bat problem has gotten over the last couple of years. Russellville, Arkansas, the U.S. Forest Service has closed nearly all its caves in Arkansas to the public in hopes of curbing the spread of the white nose syndrome, which we know is a fungus that can be fatal to bats. Now, the closure is going to be for 5 years. The caves won't open until 2019, which will allow scientists to conduct tests and try to prevent the spread of the disease, which has killed nearly 7 million bats in New England and the Mid-Atlantic states.
Dr. Day, did I hear you correctly? Did you say the white nose syndrome?
Right, yes, the white nose syndrome.
We used to have that here in Colorado back in the 70s, but it wasn't bad.
Yeah, that's a whole other thing. The bats don't have access, no.
Oh,
it's a whole different deal.
But over the last few years, we've lost millions of bats across the United States due to this white nose syndrome.
Yeah. And we all have to remember that a colony of bats will consume approximately 2,000 pounds of mosquitoes in a season.
Yeah.
That's
their body weight every night.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And they also pollinate if they don't figure this out before too long, we're going to be in serious trouble.
And you know what the greatest thing that they do, Dr. Day?
Eat mosquitoes.
They scare the hell out of my wife. She come running for the house. She'll face full-grown mountain lions and black bears and tigers, but the bat keeps her running.
I never knew that, and I've known her for many years.
It does.
All right, now I know.
Now you know.
It's on. All right, well, it looks like love is in the water in Fairbanks, Alaska. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game said that the first Yukon River spawning king salmon have reached the border with Canada. Now, as of Monday, 700 kings, also known as Chinook salmon, were detected by sonar at Eagle, just about 16 miles from the border.
Oh, well.
So it's on. These salmon are spawning.
Good. Do it.
Yes, because that makes a lot of creatures there happy, including the inhabitants.
Well, it feeds the bears and lots of animals, including a few folks that are having 4th of July cookouts.
That's right.
Yeah.
All right, Logan, Utah. Wildlife officials had to tranquilize a young moose that had wandered into a neighborhood near an elementary school on Monday this past week. Now, the moose is okay, and officials plan to release the animal high in the Logan County canyon there. Now, the moose's companion, a flying squirrel, went along peacefully.
Christ.
Yeah, okay, sorry about that one. All right, now here's some good news. The American wood stork, a bird scientist once feared would be extinct by the year 2000, has made such an impressive comeback that is getting an official status upgrade 30 years after the first list of being endangered species.
Mm.
Good news. So the tall, bald wading birds that nest in the swamps and coastal marshes from Florida to the Carolinas are now a threatened species rather than endangered.
Oh,
now
that's
that,
good.
Yeah, that's a step up, which indicates that Woodstock is no longer considered at risk of extinction.
Woodstock, huh? You know, I was thinking about what lead guitarist of the Kinks, Dave Davies, would think about this.
Well, I always thought my brother Ray, he kind of looked like a stork. We named him Stalky when he was a baby.
I am so sorry, Rick.
Yeah, see, stuff like that happens all the time.
That's all.
Now, Mr. Batson, you have a nickname for your wife.
I do.
Would you like to share that with our listeners?
Oh, sure. I call her, with love, the bipedal Wolverine.
Yeah. Yes, Cheryl. Okay. Cheryl is your wife. And well, she'll be interested in this next story. State wildlife officials have captured images of a Wolverine on the northern slope of the mountains in Utah. Now, it's the first documented sighting of the animal in Utah since a carcass was found in 1979.
Cool.
Which is not quite the same because, you know, who knows whether the carcass became a carcass there or became a carcass elsewhere and was transported to Utah.
Correct, yes. Yeah,
and
be sure.
And, you know, I do know for sure.
On TV.
Yeah, I do know for sure, though, that, Rick, that there is a Wolverine living in Rocky Mountain National Park that migrated from. Now this is what blows us away, because they had it radio collared. It migrated from the Grand Tetons in Wyoming.
Wow,
that's quite a distance.
Surely it is, and it's a very different environment too. The Tetons are very different mountains from the Rockies out here. They're very up and down, abrupt, and like that, and. I can see where he might have liked the more casual, you know.
Yeah, a little more. Yeah.
He was probably checking out the brochures and decided that would be a better place to live.
Good.
Good.
Okay.
Go ahead, Dr. Day.
Pretty much they found dozens of images from trail cameras that show the animal sniffing an empty bait station.
Oh, good.
The camels were just retrieved in June, so they were set up in February, so they just got all this information. So that's a good sign to have the warning back.
It's very cool.
All right, it's that time of the year in Nome, Alaska. More than 20 seal pups have been spotted on Nome beaches so far this year. And it's a little early for them to be birthing, but because of the recent ice disappearance, the seals are coming out early.
Global
now, other
warming.
Young seals have been seen at Whales Tiller and Shaktuklik. So the babies are in abundance, and you have to leave them alone.
Where was that last location they'd been spotted?
Shaktuklik.
Oh, okay. I just wanted you to say that again.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry. Go ahead, Dr.
All right. Well, we're off to the land of Dorothy and Dr. Day. We're heading to Kansas.
Oh,
now, good news, wildlife officials say that the bald eagles are thriving in Kansas this year, and they expect the trend to continue. There in Wichita, they've found 90 active eagle nests.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
That is really fantastic.
Yeah, that's a good thing, because there's a lot of water in Kansas. People don't really believe that, you know, they think Kansas
the size is pretty
flat.
Cool.
There's bird sanctuaries, and it's a pretty fun happening place. And, of course, since I'm from Kansas.
We won't hold that against the state, though.
please. All right, if you're fishing in Panama City Beach, Florida, and you hook into something that feels like it could be the size of an airplane. Well, it just might be. Two gutted F-101 fighter jets are at the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico as part of an artificial reef meant to attract fish, divers, and fishermen.
Cool.
Yeah, the Voodoo fighter jets were sunk on Friday, and they had been on display downtown in Panama City for the last few weeks so that people could see them before they sunk them into the bottom of the Gulf.
You know, they've done that quite often, and it's been very successful. God love them. I mean, yeah, it makes it a little dangerous for divers, you know, anytime you deal with ships or airplanes or whatever in the water, you know. But as far as the fish are concerned, that's just wonderful.
Yeah, they will love it.
Yeah.
Well, we've got an army of insects marching across Nevada. This story comes from Reno, a creepy cannibalistic bug that infested much of the state just a few years ago, maybe making another drought-related assault on the state. Experts are finding Mormon crickets marching through the desert east of Empire, which is about 100 miles north of Reno.
What do the crickets eat?
Virtually everything.
They do?
That from plants to other insects,
And if they're cannibalistic, they'd probably eat their crickets, too.
Yeah.
They'll eat anything that gets in their way. The Mormon crickets, they are a little brutal beast. Now, you know, I almost became a Mormon many years ago so I could marry Marie Osmond.
Yeah.
But it didn't quite work out, so I... All right. Let's head off to New Hampshire. Now, the loon chicks are hatching on New Hampshire's lakes, and the biologists are asking people heading for the water tomorrow on July 4th to leave the endangered birds alone, or you will suffer the consequences.
What are those consequences?
Well, there'll be a fine, imprisonment, and you might have to sit on a loon egg for a few days.
I think they should have to do that.
All right, we've got a rare Poitou donkey that was born at a Davis farm in Sterling, Massachusetts. Council Bluffs, Iowa, the city council has taken its first step towards barring people from feeding wild turkeys in downtown Council Bluffs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, wild turkeys, coming into town. Yeah, and they're concerned because the numbers have increased so much in the city that they're creating hazards in the streets, and they're finding them at a lot of the fast food restaurants, too.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, you know what happened the other day? We were coming back to the compound. We just bought the tiger food for the day, and we're heading back, and our path was completely covered with guinea hens. And even the intimidation of my moving truck, they would not move. Of course, if I would have hit one of the guinea hens, I would have had to file for divorce the next day because the wife was with me. But knowing about the danger involved, I sent her out to chase them off the road. And those weird chickens ran like the wind. And you know what the pioneers used to do, don't you, Dr. Day, Mr. Robert? Well, they always kept them around their cabins and their homesteads because they would warn them of intruders, namely Native Americans that did not have good intentions. So that's what they used as an alarm system was guinea hens.
And they're quite beautiful birds.
Yes, they are, and they're quite loud, too. So.
Now, when I lived in Florida, my neighbor had peacocks that sat on the top of his roof every night. They bedded down on the peak of the roof.
And they make the most awful sound.
And you could not get within a half a block of the house, or those peacocks would tell you.
Beautiful birds, but they make an awful sound.
And they sound like somebody being murdered.
You know.
Our neighbor had peacocks, but you see, the coyote is now indigenous to our area, so for some reason they disappeared. I don't know what happened. I'm not going to say
anything.
Seems
like they don't get along too well.
No, not very well. Coyotes love them.
Beep, beep.
Yeah, beep, beep.
All right, well, let's get along with this. We've got a very important guest on tonight, so let's finish up the Wild World News.
We have rock and roll
not
royalty.
Finding Bigfoot. Scientists analyzing over 30 hair samples reportedly left behind by mythological beasts found that all came from animals like bears, wolves, crows, raccoons, you name it.
Yeah.
Do you know, Dr. Day, I was going to tell that story when you finished, so now I won't. I was going to Massachusetts having some additions like whales and reductions like Bigfoot.
Yeah.
So.
Well,
let me tell you something, though, Rick. I'll send you a message, and if you ever get down to the San Juan Mountains, that may all change.
Well, you know, I have no doubts that there are such things as Sasquatch. You know, I mean, there are so many things that we don't have any idea about. And things that I have a personal experience, and I will swear to this over whatever anyone has to say. I know that panthers are in no way indigenous to Colorado. But on my way home one evening from going to Susan Vernon's play, there was a panther there. I mean,
black.
He was in the road, and he went up the bank, and no one can tell me otherwise. And he could have been a reverse albino mountain lion, but he was black, and he was the size of a mountain lion, and he was a feline. And that much, I mean, he was 5 or 6 feet from me, and believe me, I'm sure of what I saw. And
oh,
not
sure.
Imbibing anything, so, you know, there you go. That's
our
just
guest
my story.
Really cool tonight, Dr. Day.
That is cool.
Yeah, it is cool.
Could it have been a jaguar?
Well, that's just about as indigenous to Colorado as
a panther,
but it could have been. You know.
Good point, so, Dr. Day.
We've heard so many stories about everything moving north. I mean, they're finding tarantulas in Missouri and Illinois now.
Oh, yeah.
With the global warming.
Oh, yeah.
So anything is possible, I guess.
Well, yeah. Well, you know, and this is a little more easy to explain, but one day when my wife and I were still living in Boulder, we had a big peacock fly into our patio. And peacocks are not particularly well known to be around these areas either. But it turned out that there was a gentleman about a mile away that was raising peacocks and donkeys. And this one escaped from his place and came to our place in the rain. I don't know what.
Wow.
But, you know, you see things that you aren't expecting to see. You know, what the heck?
There is such a thing, Rick, as a melanistic cougar, which makes them entirely black. Very, very, very rare. Very rare. So you're a lucky man.
Because I was in the mountains. I mean, I was up in the mountains. Believe me, so. Whatever.
You're a very lucky man to have seen that. Yeah.
That's interesting. But I guarantee you, I would swear that on a stack of Bibles. I know what I saw.
I'm envious. I can't help it.
But
yeah, that's cool.
Well,
when I lived in Panama, I was... lived in Gamboa, which is in the middle of the isthmus there, about 20 miles from Balboa Heights, which is on the Pacific side. I was on a little straight track of land. I saw a jaguar come out of the jungle, and there was probably, 80 yards of foliage that was cut down. I swear he took 3 leaps. He was across the road and into the jungle again.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, most incredible thing I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Amazing.
All right, well, we're going to do Who Got Older this week, and I'm just going to run through it because we've taken so much time with the wild world news. Bruce Johnson of the Beach Boys turned 72 this week.
Oh.
A very nice man.
Very nice.
Do you know Bruce?
Nice man.
Yeah,
I do.
Cool.
Yeah. We had Al on the show last year, I believe it was.
Al Jardine, yep.
That's right. We had Al on the show. We're big Beach Boy fans. And Deborah Harry of Blondie turned 69.
That's a miracle.
All right, now for our wild world fact of the day. July 4th is the biggest hot dog holiday of the year. Yes, with Americans consuming about 155 million of them on Independence Day alone.
Oh, my God.
Well, you know,
we love
our health food here.
That's right, and I will be participating. All right, well, that's the Wild World News for July 3rd.
Well, once again, a great job done by Dr. Henry Day and his staff at the Wild World News headquarters in Indianapolis, Indiana, now HD, newly renovated. And how does that new knotty pine paneling look in the studio, Dr. Day?
It's really nice. It's knotty enough that it reflects the sound. It's beautiful.
Oh, good. I want to remind everyone to check out my website, LarryTheAnimalGuy.com. Tell us all about our wildlife rescue work that we do, also our wildlife education programs, and our Facebook page, Larry the Animal Guy and Friends, filled with lots of videos about wildlife. It tells the latest about our animal family and our visits to schools, and, man, we've been going to Bible schools this year, and libraries and all kind of private events. It's been phenomenal. And that all makes it possible for Wild World to be on Blog Talk Radio.
tell me what's wrong. And if you think it might help, I can bring my guitar and sing you a song. Now I know love has made a fool of others, and I guess love has made a fool of me. So try and answer questions that you never even asked of me. I know you've been left in doubt by the things that you're not sure about. Well, I can say I've been there too. And maybe we can both find out if you will tell me why you are crying and what I can do. It's not so easy just watching you cry alone. Can you tell me what's wrong? And if you think it might help, I can bring my guitar and sing you a song. You say there's no way I can help, and in the end that might be true, but you never know until you try, and that's all that I've asked to do. Now I can see you have your secrets, and that's alright, I have mine too, but you should always share your troubles, makes it that much easier on you. So tell me why you are crying and what I can do. It's not so easy just watching you cry alone. Can you tell me what's wrong? And if you think it might help, I can bring my guitar and sing you a song. Sing a song.
Blessed tonight with rock and roll royalty from the Flying Burrito Brothers and the infamous band Firefall. Our guest tonight, Rick Roberts, all the way from his home in Longmont, Colorado. And I have to tell you, Rick, the gentleman that procures our music, it puts it together for us each week, and he'll put these little montages of various hits. He sent me the two downloads, and he says, I am not going to cut any of these songs up because they're too good.
Well, thank you. That's very nice. Well, you know, it's a funny story. If you have time for a story.
Yeah, we do.
That's why we're here. I was hoping we did. But that song, Why Are You Crying? That whole album was the first album I ever did. I just had turned 21 when we did it, and all that. It was 43 years ago, in fact, and a month or two. But that song, Why Are You Crying, we had just about finished with the record. And I took that song in. I'd written it the night before. I took it in. I played it for him in the studio. They said, that goes on. We cut it that day, the day after I wrote it, and the next day it was a finished piece of work on the record, and we submitted the record the day after that. So in 3 days it went from in my head to in the hands of the record company.
Wow.
For the album. And, you know, I was astonished because everything, especially to a young guy just off the streets and everything like that, seems to take forever. You know, I mean, what are the longest 6 or 8 weeks period in a young recording artist's life is the time between when we turn in an album and the time it's released. It seems like an eternity. And it's really only a month or two, you know, but you're waiting and waiting. And in fact, another little aside on that, before the record actually came out, I didn't really understand about how everything works with time, you know. But a friend of mine and I was living at a converted fraternity house by UCLA, and this other guy and I were going over to spend a glorious afternoon at the UCLA Botanical Gardens, and with a little chemical assistance. You know, this was the 70s, remember? And
nice.
And we're young guys, you know. So we took Dr. David Leary's advice about certain things. And anyway, we were heading over to the Botanical Gardens. And on the radio, on the FM radio, on comes, I think it was James Taylor's Something Off of Fire and Rain or something like that. And I said, wait a second. And then we'll walk out of the door, and right after that, I hear the chords that sounded exactly like Colorado. And the record would not be out for about three more weeks. And I went, wait a minute, Keith. You know, I want to hear this. So it was Colorado. And they followed up with a Joni Mitchell song. And I thought, that's great company to be in, but how did they get the boot? Is that a bootleg or what? So I called all these people, panicked. They've got a record. They, you know, they're playing on the radio. They said, of course. They always release them early to the DJs and everything so they can preview them and all that stuff. So
sure.
I thought it was not anything to be alarmed about. But I was, I went, oh, no, this is, my career's over before it starts. I heard nothing. Oh, no. And, you know, it was nice afternoon. It was, you know, so... That sums that up, you know.
I have a feeling when we talked to Dave Davies of the Kinks, he talked about early in his career, and he was trying to make a point, and I says, Dave, were you a little cocky? he goes, yes, I was a little cocky. How would he say it, Dr. Dave?
Well, yes, I was a little cocky, Larry.
Well, you know, arrogance is a disease that afflicts a lot of rock and rollers, especially early in their career. I in my new band, one of these must have attributes that they had to have was to be a nice guy, because the way I told them, I said, I don't want to be in a band anymore. I've done this, I've been there, and all that stuff. I don't want to be in a band with any guy who's going to go around saying to people, hi, I'm in a band. You should get to know me. It'd be good for you. You know, because we've all seen that attitude, you know, from guys. You get this feeling that, like, I am really an extraordinary person, you know. And pretty soon, you know, this thing called real life comes along and knocks you around a little bit. And you go, oh, yeah? Why? You're so special? How does this feel? You know? And you go, I don't, maybe not. Maybe I was wrong, you know. But, I can imagine with that, especially with the British invasion and all those bands and all that, I would have been just cockier than you could name. You know? So, unbelievable. And, you know, it's really a strange thing. There are a lot of guys who are really nice guys when they go into their career. And you meet up with them again a few years later, and they're real jerks. But every now and then you meet somebody who starts off being kind of a jerk and turns into a really nice guy. And in a case in point I'm thinking of is Dan Fogelberg. You know,
yeah.
I, in 1972 or 3, in a couple of years when I was doing a solo act, and I had two albums out, and I was in Kentucky, and Dan opened for me. And I think it must have been 73 because I was thinking about getting a band. So I put Firefall together shortly after that. But I had it in mind. So after I heard him play, I thought, this guy is great. So I went to him and said, you know, Dan, I said, you really are good. I said, look, I'm thinking of putting a band together. Would you be interested in being in a band? And he looked at me and said, when I join a band, it'll be my band. Get it? And he turned around and walked away. And I thought, what
God.
A jerk. And the thing is then, over the years, he came to live in Colorado, and we got to be a little closer. And I didn't see him that often, but each time I'd see him on maybe a six-month or a year lapse between times, he was more gracious and a nicer man. And just, I mean, by the end of his life, he was an extraordinary gentleman. He was just really a nice guy with, you know, nothing but good things to say to people and always polite and friendly and all this stuff. And no attitude at all. He just,
wow.
He had found some success and he wore it well. It made him, you know, it sort of made him feel good. And he didn't feel the need to, like, I'm really something special here, you know.
I kind of sensed that in him when he was a young artist.
I have to say, Rick, Dr. Day, we've had so many people. I call them classic rock artists from, I mean, it's gone on and on. We are so lucky, tonight included. But they've all been pretty, there's only one guest that I can think of that was kind of tough, and he wasn't really that tough. We've been spoiled.
Yeah, we have.
because they've all been so forthcoming, from Dave Davies to Al Jardine and Chris France, Jimmy Greenspoon, and Rick Roberts is right in that pile. I hate to say that. No, I don't hate to say that.
Well, you know, the thing is, once again, because you're mentioning, are guys who have been at it for a while and have realized that, you know, there, you know, it's nice that you have a talent and all that stuff, but, you know, so does almost everyone have some talent, and you kind of get a little more perspective on things, you know.
Sure.
When you're a young person out there, you know, and you go on stage and there's 10 or 15 or more thousand people out there screaming for you and everything like that, it's a real rush, I have to admit it, you know. And and the people that you meet and you see on the road particularly are all there, the ones that came to the concert, they paid to come and see you. Okay, that's one thing. The other people are catering to you right and left, and your business associates at the record companies, they're all fluffing you up all every which way and all this stuff, and you get a very distorted perspective of things, you know. And then as time goes by, and Chris Hillman told me one time, he said, look, man, you know, he said, you know, if whatever you do, you know, next time you have some success, he said, don't get arrogant again, okay? I did that. He said after the Birds, he said he was really an arrogant jerk. And then he came down a little bit. The Burritos, you know, the Burritos did pretty well here, but I'll tell you, in Europe, the Burritos were huge. The Burritos outpolled the Rolling Stones one year on a popularity poll. I mean, they were big there, you know. And he said, I got arrogant again. And then I promised myself I wasn't going to do that. And then he had his band, the Desert Rose Band, and they had two or three number one singles. Instead of that, I was doing it again. So really, Rick, try your best. Don't get arrogant again. And I said, well, Chris, you know, I stepped out of it for a long time. So, you know, whether I do well again or not, I've seen too much other stuff, you know, to think that's, it's a waste of time, you know. So,
well,
it
had to be, gosh, to join the Flying Burrito Brothers, who had been so big, that had to be just mind-boggling. And I've go ahead.
Well, you know, it was really neat because I was literally off the street. I went to L.A. from Washington, D.C. on a false premise. I was playing a hootenanny in Washington, D.C., and after I did my set, this guy came up to me and he said, you know, I think you're really good. I'd like to make a record with you. Maybe you've heard of me. My name is Paul Rothschild. Now, Paul Rothschild is the guy who produced The Doors and Janis Joplin. And before me, later on, he went to some other people. But, of course, I heard of him. I said, well, yes. He said, okay, look, I'm based in L.A., but if you'll get out there on your own, I'll put you on a retainer, which at that point, anybody who knew anything about music would have been going, wait a minute, something's wrong here, because it doesn't work that way. But he said, I'll put you on a retainer until I finish my current project, and then we'll do a record. So he gave me his address and sent me on my way. Well, I hitchhiked cross-country and went to L.A. and went to his house, the address he'd given me, and a guy comes to the door, this little Jewish man, and I said, I'm here to see Paul. He said, I'm Paul. I said, no, you're not. He said, yeah, I am. And I said, well, and the thing is, I was so naive. The guy in Washington, D.C., Paul Rothschild was like a 5'7" little Jewish man who looked like a little Jewish man. He was bald with rather prominent nose and like this. He looked like what you'd imagine a little Jewish guy looked like. And Rothschild is a pretty Jewish name, you know. The guy in D.C. was a 6'3" black guy. I don't know that many black Jewish people. You know, so I might have spelled a rat at the beginning, but I wanted to believe, yeah, I'm really good. So I went out, and with that deflation of knowing that I had not been discovered after all, you know, that I was out there like everybody else. And by the way, he was kind enough to bring me into his house and let me play him a few songs. And he said, you know, I see some promise there, but you're entering a whole new arena here. And so why don't you go out for 6 or 8 months and get acquainted with your fellow musicians and see what you're up against here, what the level of player, you know, playmanship is or musicianship.
Mm-hmm.
And then come back. And I was deflated. I mean, I didn't know what to do. And so I was on the street. I auditioned for a dozen companies and did demos for about 6 or 8 of them. And all of them said, boy, you know, you're a good singer, but the songs, I don't know. Or else they said, you're a good songwriter. I like those songs, but your voice, meh. Or else they said, hey, good singer, good songs, but you need a band. But one way or the other, the answer was no. And you know, finally, when I was about ready to give up, this guy who was a coordinator, a liaison man for UCLA and Columbia Records, convinced me to go back there and audition a second time for their new guy. And I played him a few songs, and he said, you know, you're really good, but you need a band. And I'd heard that enough. And I was packing up my guitar. I said, what are you doing? Sit down. And he was on the phone already, so I figured I'd take enough time for his day. But what he was on the phone for, he was calling Eddie Tichter, the Burrito Brothers manager. And they had just parted company with Graham Parsons, and so mm-hmm. they were kind of, you know, treading water at the time. So
sure.
He made the connection for me. His name was Alan Rindy. And, you know, and I eventually auditioned for them. And we tried it out. The first gig I ever played with him was the Whiskey A Go-Go opening for the
Wow.
Bird.
Cool.
And that in itself boggled my mind, you know. And
I
heard in the dressing room between shows, Clarence White for the Birds walked up to Chris and said, Chris, who's that boy singing with you? Is he in the band or just trying out? Chris said, well, we're checking it out. And Clarence said, well, you better get him because otherwise I would talk to Roger McGuinn and get him in our band. And I'm sitting there listening to this going, what? And about 5 minutes later, Chris walked into the room where I was sitting and said, hey, want to be a burrito? And I said, yes. You know, so it was all kind of unexpected. And it did.
Well, that's a great story.
That is a fantastic story.
6 months before I did my first shows with him, I was sitting in the Free Press bookstore in Westwood, L.A. area with a bucket playing for tips, you know. And so it was suddenly to be traveling around the country and ultimately around the world, you know, was pretty heady stuff indeed. You know, it was also kind of interesting because for a year or two, people were saying, you know, I like the band and all, but where's Graham? Because I'd taken Graham Parsons' place, and Graham was a legend among a certain set of people, you know, and still is, even more so since he passed away. And, you know, like that. But nonetheless, it was quite an education.
Well, your spirit, you deserve that. That was what was meant to be, so.
Just hitchhiking across the United States is a book in itself.
Well, I'll tell you what, there were some interesting adventures. I was in Kansas City, just outside. No, excuse me, I was in St. Louis, in Missouri there. And I, you know, got picked up by these three Polish guys who had just come to this country. They had been here for about 2 months, living with some relatives in Chicago. And now they decided to set out to see the country. And they didn't like long-haired guys. I don't know why they threw me off. I had shoulder length hair. But we would go by other long-haired hitchhikers, and they would slow down and throw these 16-ounce full cans of beer trying to hit the guys. You know,
gosh.
And pretty soon I said, I think maybe I should get out here. Said, no, you said you're going to Denver. No, you said, you come on. And pretty soon they had me take a shift driving and all this stuff. And, I mean, you know, I have written my memoir because there are a lot of stories. But I won't reveal what was so special about there. But there was an incident. I will tell you this. When they dropped me off in Denver, they had taken my guitar when I got in and put it in the trunk, and I just got in the car. But when I got out, I went back behind to the trunk where they were getting my guitar out. And they opened up, and there must have been 60 guns in there, rifles, pistols, shotguns, guns I could not name. But you know, and they weren't terrorists. They were just very well armed. You know?
Yeah.
And I thought, holy cow. You know, and I made tracks to get as far away from there as I could. I didn't say anything to any policeman because I was a hippie, and hippies did not talk to the man.
Yeah, right.
You know,
no.
Not in 1969.
No.
So, whatever. But, you know, I mean, all these things. And I ended up in San Francisco. Because I was looking for, there's a band, Nils Ofgren and Grin at that point. Now Nils, of course, has played with Bruce Springsteen. But I had known those guys in Washington, D.C. And since I was hitchhiking, they took one suitcase for me because I couldn't really carry it. And I was supposed to hook up with them out west and, you know, get my suitcase. So they told me they'd be in San Francisco for a while. They were being flown out by Neil Young to make a record, but they were going to be up there for a little while. So I said, well, where can I find you? So they sent me to the Airplane House, you know. So I go up there, and I knock at the door, and this guy answers the door, and I don't know for sure, but I compared pictures later, and I think it was Spencer Dryden. But I'm there with a shoulder bag and my guitar, and he says, yeah. I said, I'm looking for Grin. He said, I don't know who that is. I said, well, it's a band. They brought a suitcase for me, and he said, wait a minute, this is my guitar. He said, are you a player? And, of course, there were a legion of talented people out there in California at that point trying to make it, you know. And I said, yeah, I'm going to California. I'm going to L.A. to make my first record. He said, well, come on and play me a couple songs. And I got a couple housemates here that when they come back, they might know who you're talking about, you know. So I go in, and I sit down in the upstairs hallway area, but I'm sitting there, and I'm playing a couple songs with my eyes closed. I open my eyes, and I'm looking at Paul Kantner and Grace Slick, you know, and I'm trying to be casual. I say, oh, man, your friend said you might know where Grin is, you know, and they said, Grin, is that, you know, I said, oh, well, I'm trying to put it in context. I said, well, Neil Young brought him out here to make a record. He's their protege. And Paul Kantner said, well, I don't know anything about them, but I know where Neil is. He's, and therefore I can pinpoint the date because of what he said. He said he's down at Esalen Institute playing at something called the Big Sur Folk Festival they're having. It was September 14th of 1969. And so I hitchhiked down there, and I got next to Neil Young and asked him about Grin, and he gave me an address in L.A., So I thought, okay, finally. So I go to the address in L.A., and I knock at the door, and the door opens, and it's Joni Mitchell. He'd given me the wrong address. And I went, okay, I know this is the thing. And she just holds up her hand, like, to stop, you know, and she says, Willie. And Willie is what everybody called Graham Nash. So Graham Nash walks around the back of the house carrying a garbage can. Says, well, what's up, Mike? Can I help you? You know, I'm going, oh, this is, I'm dreaming. I'm still in Washington, D.C. I've never left there. It's all a dream. You know, and they sent me to another place. Ultimately, and this is why I'm telling this long story, because in the search of my suitcase and Grin, because I didn't know anybody out in L.A., I'm hitchhiking up Laurel Canyon one day, and this blue Mustang stops, and I run up there to get in the car and thank for the ride, and it's Dennis Wilson, the drummer for the Beach Boys. So, I mean, I know this sounds surreal, but my friends have told me, you know, I guess it was just meant to happen, you know. But by this point, I had found that I hadn't been discovered. I was there. I said, hey, here's the chance. I said, look, here's what happened. I thought I was coming out here, I'm telling the story. And he says, well, you're in luck. My brothers and I are forming a new record company called Brother Records. So go over to 1654 Ivar and see Fred Vail, and he'll audition you, see if you got anything. So I did that. And they did my first demo for me at Brian Wilson's house on Bellagio Road. He had a studio there. Oh, wow. And we went over there and did that. And that's what got me enough confidence to say, okay, discovered it. I'm going to stick it out over here and see what happens. So there you go.
That's so cool.
There's my long-winded story.
Oh, we loved every moment of it.
Yeah, that's unbelievable.
Oh, my. Hey, we have to take a short break. We're going to be back in just a few. Our guest tonight, Rick Roberts of, Firefall and the Flying Burrito Brothers, among others. It's a great hour or 90 minutes, I should say, everybody. So we'll be right back on Blog Talk Radio.
Stay tuned. We'll be back with more of Larry Batson's Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio.
Sassy! Sassy!
This week's episode, Bobcat in the Cave.
Gosh, Johnny, playing in the cave sure is neat.
Oh, boy, a kitty cat.
Sassy, the kitty cat's yelling.
What, Sassy? It's not a kitty? It's a bobcat? Speaking of cats, you like to stress the importance of adopting cats from animal shelters? Over 5 million cats go into animal shelters every year? And with millions of healthy cats to choose from, it's a shame more people don't adopt from shelters?
It's bobcat heavy. Help, Sassy!
Why bother? We'll just get into more trouble tomorrow?
What's that supposed to mean?
Oh, nuts.
Sassy is brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org. Remember,
Here's a hot topic about our wildlands and living with the natural role of fire.
Yard work is not just a matter of pride when you live in the wildland-urban interface. It's also about survival. Here are some FireWise tips that can help protect your home from wildland fire. Prune your trees 6 to 10 feet above the ground. Remove dead leaves and branches and dispose of them before fire season. Water your lawn regularly and store firewood away from the house. Be prepared for a fire emergency by having a plan for your family and pets. Learn more at our website and then sit back and enjoy. You worked for it.
This hot topic was made possible by the Teresa and H. John Hines III Foundation. Learn more about the natural role of fire, how to protect your community, and get the latest fire information. Visit the National Interagency Fire Center website at NIFC.gov. That's NIFC.gov.
We're Rascal Flatts.
There's a place where ordinary people do extraordinary things every day. That place is called the American Red Cross. When you help the American Red Cross, you help America. Call 1-800-RED-CROSS or visit redcross.org to learn more.
Ranger Station, Ranger speaking.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to report a bear sighting.
Location?
In the forest, near the side of the road.
No need for alarm, sir. The forest is where bears live.
But this was no ordinary bear.
No ordinary bear?
Yeah, one second I'm having a smoke taken in the view. Next thing I know, I am face to face with Smokey Bear.
Let me guess, Smokey had a tip for you.
He did. He must have seen me toss my cigarette on the ground. He told me never to do that because it only takes one spark to start a wildfire.
He's a smart bear. Did you know that 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans? That means 9 out of 10 wildfires can be prevented.
That's what Smokey said. I had no idea.
That's why Smokey's famous, and you're not.
Good point.
Get your Smokey on. If you see someone in danger of starting a wildfire, step in and make a difference, because 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans. Brought to you by Smokey Bear, the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council. Learn more at SmokeyBear.com.
Only you can prevent wildfires.
Welcome back to Larry Batson's Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio. Once again, here's your host, Larry Batson.
On Blog Talk Radio. You can go back into our archives and hear the many shows we've had, including tonight, rock and roll artist Rick Roberts is with us, Grimmy's Jimmy Greenspoon from Three Dog Night, Chris France from Talking Heads, Dave Davies from The Kinks, Al Jardine from The Beach Boys. It goes on and on, so please check out our archives. That's www.blogtalkradio.com. They make it possible.
It's not
In the middle of that, did you?
What, again? Didn't hear a crash, did you say?
Oh, good. You did not hear it. Well, that's good.
No, I didn't. But that's okay.
Well, I tumbled out of the studio chair. And
I see. Well, I see. I won't even comment. Just leave that alone.
No need to. Firefall.
So, I will say, though, that you know, since we did Why Are You Crying the other day, normally my songs don't just come tumbling out. But that song, Just Remember I Love You, is another one that I wrote in the course of one night. And it was in self-defense. I had just come back from Miami making the first record, and I had met a young lady down there, and I brought her back with me. And in those days, I did my share of cocaine, wrote a lot of songs on it, in fact. And at times I would get into binge situations where I would grab a couple hours sleep a night and sit up with my guitar the rest of the night. So after I had been in a stage like that for about 4 days, the fifth night arrived, and the young lady was going up to bed. She said, "Well, are you going to come to bed, or are you going to sit there with your guitar, your cocaine again?" And the way she said it, I knew I was really in deep water, you know, unless I came up with something. So in the course of that midnight to about 7 o'clock in the morning, I wrote that song from the get-go to the finished product, complete, so that when she came downstairs, I said, "So let's do this," you know, and played this song. She said, "That's pretty good," you know. I said, "Yeah," and she wasn't mad, and so I got away with murder, you know, basically, because otherwise it would have been the end of the relationship, I'm sure, right then.
That's a beautiful song, and the way it's arranged, it's just magnificent. If you listen to, you know, the instruments, the less is more.
I really like it, too. And I love what David Muse, the saxophone player, did. And, you know, David was not actually, he was not an official member of the band. If you look at the first album cover, there are only five of us on there. And David was already in the band. He was on the entire first album and everything else. But when they took the pictures, he wasn't in the band yet. And, we had, three guitars, Jack Bartley, Larry Burdett, and myself, bass and drums. And I thought we needed something else to complete the sound of the band. So David is somebody that I grew up with in Clearwater, Florida. And we played in our very, very first band together. He was playing bass at the time, not very well. But I had heard that he'd become a good sax and flute player and pretty good keyboard player over the years. So I called him, because we were still good pals, and I said, "David, you know, we're looking for a utility infielder, somebody to fill in whatever a song needs. I hear you're getting pretty good on sax and flute. Do you think you could cover that on, you know, a first-class basis?" I said, "We've got Mark Andes from Spirit and Michael Clark from the Birds and Burrito Brothers. You know, well, what about it? You know, are you up to it?" He said, "Well, I think so." So he came on out of here while I spent that summer on tour with Stephen Stills' band. And when I came back, David had come out and jammed some with the band, and before I get back, I already knew, because they said, "Hey, would you like to get David Muse in this band?" I said, "You bet." So he became the official sixth member, and what he did to a lot of the music was change it. It gave it a sound of its own. It was not like anybody else exactly at the time. So,
well, you guys were just putting out hit after hit. It was just absolutely amazing. And I'm sure you know a friend of our show, Joe Vitale.
Oh, Joe's a good friend. Joe played drums on most of my second solo album. In fact,
he's the best.
He's really good.
Good
his son is on my Facebook friend list, and it looks exactly like Joe. But, I'll tell you what, that's the one thing. You know, I have a new band now called Winter Rose. Mm-hmm. And we're doing some of the Firefall stuff. So, you know, they're my songs, you know, so I figure I can't not do them.
Sure.
I'm concentrating on new stuff because I have a whole lot of stuff that was not written yet when I left Firefall. But we're doing some of those things. And, you know, we're doing different arrangements because we do not have a sax player in this band. We have six very good guys, including myself. If I myself, six good guys.
Sure.
But, we have two guitars, one electric, one acoustic, a bass player, a drummer, and a keyboard player who's really good as well. And, we could fake a sax sound, but we prefer to kind of rearrange the material, you know, if it works best that way. And the only thing, there are certain things I go, "I wish we had a sax here," you know. But, you know, it's pretty cool, so I'm very happy with it. I think it's going to be a very, very good thing. We're starting our performance thing in the middle of the next month. We've been working on this for a few months now to get it, you know, tuned up and ready to
go. Sure.
And so that's there. But David's contribution was, you know, incredible to Firefall. And not to mention that Jock Bartley is an amazing guitar player. Jock started with Johnny Smith, who has a Gibson guitar named after him. It's one of the all-time icons of jazz guitar, and Jock took lessons from him from about age 11. And Jock really played some incredible things. So it was a lucky thing, the whole group. So
we've been blessed to have played with some wonderful musicians, and one of them, Chris Hillman of the Byrds. And I have to tell you, Rick, my favorite song ever released by the Byrds, I used to belong, now you'll probably remember this, the Columbia Record Club.
Oh, yeah.
That was, you know, you hoard a whole bunch of albums and never pay for it. No, I take that back. But anyway, the first album come out, Mr. Tambourine Man with the Byrds. And you know what my favorite song on there, and this is no big secret, I mean among Byrds fans, was I Feel a Whole Lot Better.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I got to play with G, too. He's the writer of that song.
I know.
He did it every night. I played in the 80s with a band called the 20th Anniversary Salute to the Byrds. And it was an incredible band. It had Gene Clark and Michael Clark, no relation, from the original Byrds. And it had John York from the Latter-day Byrds. And then it had Blondie Chaplin from the Beach Boys, the guy who sang Sail on Sailor and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it had Ricky Danko and Richard Manuel from the band. And and me, and it was a heavyweight thing. And when Richard Manuel left, we replaced him with Nicky Hopkins. You know, so actually, with you know, I mean, it wasn't too much of a fall off in quality. You know, and I just posted a picture of that, in fact, the other day in my Facebook thing, and mentioned that Blondie, Chaplin and Nicky Hopkins were the only two Rolling Stones we could get to be in the band, you know, because they were both in the Rolling Stones at one time or another, you know. So that was great fun. But Gene was a really underrated guy. You know, he gave a lot to the Byrds, but he left early, partially on account of a great fear of flying. He left the band one day. They got on a plane, and he said, he got up and said, I can't do it, and he left, and that was it.
Wow.
And then he did a number of things solo or, you know, in other configurations with the musicians, and never got the attention that he should have gotten. He was quite a genius and a really, really nice man. You know, big warm-hearted, easygoing Kansas guy, since we talked about Kansas earlier.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, whatever. But, yeah, I have been very lucky. I've gotten to play with a lot of guys that I... The amazing thing is that I've gotten to play with so many people that I grew up listening to. Yeah, I was a generation behind them. But by falling in with the Fabrino Brothers, it started kind of a chain reaction, you know. And so I was talking the other day with Richie Fury from Buffalo Springfield and Poco.
Mm-hmm.
He is the minister of my church here. And, you know, I mentioned to him that he is the only one of the entire Byrds band and all of the living members of Buffalo Springfield that I have not either been in the studio or on stage with. And he said, well, we have to change that. I said, that's fine with me. And so it's amazing.
Praise
because
Lord.
I did. I came along a generation later, and I just fell in with those guys. So lucky for me. Yeah.
Well, I know Joe was upset that he only did 5 shows at the Buffalo Springfield, 5 or 6.
Yeah.
And he said, man, he said, we were just getting hot. He said,
should
have done about 20 at least.
Yeah, I know. Well, you know, they were due to go out again, but Neil decided he didn't want to do it, you know, and there was not really an explanation for that. But Neil was kind of at the controls, so when Neil said no, it kind of went on indefinite hold. So I don't know if it will come together. You know, Stephen Stills is just like, he's having trouble with hearing, and he's kind of stepped back a little bit from where he was. He's a genius, still a genius, and all that stuff, you know. But you know, he it took him some time, I guess, is what I've been told at least, to build up his confidence with that band. So, and Joey was doing a number of his parts for Stephen because Stephen was having trouble hearing him. But once Stephen got his confidence back, from what I understand, he was killing it. He was doing a great job, and they really got hot towards the end of the thing. I guess they ended up at Bonnaroo or something like that for their last shows, and I heard they were just magnificent then.
I'll bet. I have the old story from Bill Graham, his book, about when he was handling the Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young tour in the late 70s.
Uh-huh.
And they were at a motel, or a hotel, I should say. Steve had come out of the pool, and he said, he walked up to Bill, and he says, "Well, I'm feeling much better. I thought I might have to cancel tonight's show, but I'm feeling so much better, I think I'll be able to do it." And Bill Graham told him, he says, "Well, that's really good news." And after that, though, I would have had all your legs broken.
I know. Bill Graham was not, you know, he did not fool around with any garbage from any of his players, you know. He said,
"No,
you're here, you're supposed to do a job, you better do it," you know, and like that. I mean, we got to play for him. Actually, with the Burritos, we played Fillmore East, and with Firefall, we played Fillmore West and Winterland.
Yeah.
And so I had just a passing acquaintance with him, but he was a no-nonsense guy. He really knew what was expected of him and what was expected of the people he hired, and he did that. You know, it was a great thing. He was really wonderful for music, and, you know, all those guys are just, I know them all, but still, you know, I go, wow, how did you do what you did? You know, because some of those guys, Crosby is the most amazing singer in terms of harmony parts that I've ever heard. And the thing is, he came out of Madrigal training. You know, he was a Madrigal singer in those big choruses that do all those odd harmonies and everything. So he had a better handle on that than anybody I've ever seen. And it showed up in some of the arrangements that they had with that band.
Okay.
And, you know, so whatever. But it's mind-boggling to me to this day, you know, some of those guys. It was a wonderful time for music back in the late 60s, early 70s throughout, you know, that kind of got put upon heavily by disco, and then after that rap and hip-hop and all that stuff, you know, where the requirements for quality have kind of slipped a little, you know. When I was doing a lot of stuff, there was a sort of an unwritten rule that you had to have at least two chords in your song and more than three or four notes and one line of lyric in your melody. And somebody canceled those rules somewhere along the line. I don't know when, but it doesn't make me real happy, you know. So, but whatever. You know, there's still a lot of good music out there. It's just very hard to find now because the record companies are no longer in control like they were. And anybody with Pro Tools and things like that, anybody can go in and make a record for $1,000, which opens the door to everybody doing that, you know. And so it's really like finding a needle in a haystack to find the really quality things that are out there trying to break through. Yeah, it was the record company concept had its ups and downs. There's good points and bad. One of the bad points, of course, was that they controlled everything. But at the same time, they served as a filter. And if you couldn't impress a record company, you know, you just didn't get to make a record. And in some cases, that was awful because some really talented people got overlooked or just didn't meet whatever it was the companies were looking for. But you didn't have that glut of people. I know bands here that people say, "Well, we've been together for 6 weeks and we haven't made an album yet, but we're gonna fix that." You know, I go, 6 weeks, and you go, "Wait," because they feel like they're overdue, and I'm going, "What?" You know, and there's no more working your way up through the clubs and learning your craft and all that stuff. And forgive me while I rail on about this, but you know, it's really disappointing at the fact that it's just such an open door that a lot of stuff gets out there that really doesn't need to be, you know?
Yeah.
And it makes it hard to find the really quality stuff.
Well, you're not the first one that said that on this show. Shelley Leibowitz of SRI Records, who started off with the Brat Pack in Las Vegas, to the Rolling Stones. I mean, he flat said the Rolling Stones worked their butts off to get where they're
at. He said the Rolling Stones what?
He said the Rolling Stones flat work their butts off to get where they were.
Oh, they do. They absolutely do. Yeah, sure. those guys, and, you know, I mean, they're a level above, you know. I mean, those guys, and how they've been able to do it. Well, for them, how Keith Richards has been able to stay alive. But, you know,
yeah.
How they've been able to hang on for all these years and still be putting out stuff, you know. And of course, I mean, you know, forgive me for being an old fogey, but I don't think that anyone has ever exploded with the amount of talent that really came into bloom after they showed up on the scene as the Beatles. Those guys were a work in progress from start to finish, and they just kept, every time they do something, they just raise the bar again the next time around and just kept upping it.
I have to tell you, I had to make a road trip today, and the two albums I put in my car was with the Beatles, their first Capitol album, and A Hard Day's Night.
You bet.
My God.
Their first albums, they sound like what they were at that time, which was a club band fresh from Germany and like that. But you could still see the sparks of creative genius that were there. When you look back on it, in hindsight, you could see it there. Then they just had a fresh sound. But along about that third album, along about Rubber Soul or so, they just took it to a whole new level. And then they just kept doing that time after time, you know. So, I mean, as a songwriter, my jaw drops. You know, I go, how'd they do that, you know?
Well,
and, I mean, it's really such.
You know, Dave Davies said, we were a bit cocky. They weren't even close to the Beatles.
Oh, no. No, I mean, and there were so many good bands from over there. I mean, the Yardbirds were a great band, and the Hollies were a great band, and the Searchers were a great band. You know, they got some attention, but none of them could hold a candle to the Beatles. You know what I mean? I know a lot of my peers that have been around all this time and have done a lot of things, and they still say, the Beatles, I just tip my hat and bend over with a bow of your serve, sir, you know, because you're the guys, you know.
Every once in a while when I'm feeling kind of blah, I put on Bulldog. That changes my whole aspect about everything.
Definitely. Well, you know, we just, the other day in rehearsal with my new band, we were talking about, we're mostly doing my stuff, but I wanted to put in a few outside songs in. And, you know, because one thing, I want the other guy, lead singer guy, to be able to sing some songs and not just have me on the mic all the time, or the center mic, whatever. One of the songs that we chose was a song called Fast As You, which is by, I'm blocking his name. He's a country guy. But he did this as a solo vocal. And the way we're arranging it, we're doing it with a lead vocal and a seventh and a second as the harmony stack, which may or may not mean anything to you, but some of the guys out there will know what I'm talking about. But it's a harmony stack kind of like that Beatles song, The Word.
Right.
You know, and it's not the usual harmony stack of things is 1-3-5, you know, and this is 1-7-2, which, you know, is a whole different thing, you know, but it's a real neat sound and stuff like that. And so I'm just, you know, I really like the thing. I like a lot of what we're doing. I promised my band I would talk about it a little bit. I do. Winter Rose is going to be a good band. They're you know, we've got the goods, got good players, and we've got, I think, good material to work with, my stuff and L. And
sure will be.
And, you know, and we have good people behind us who want to help. You know, luckily, as I said at the very outset, I said, you know, being a nice guy was one of the mandatory requirements to be in the band. There are a lot of people around here who are very interested in wanting to do anything they can to help us along. So, and it's just because the guys in the band have left a good taste in their mouths. By the way, the guy that was Dwight Yoakam is the name, is the artist with
Dwight.
So, just blocking it out. So, anyway,
Rick, how did you come up with the name?
It's a funny thing because it's a real inspirational thing. There's a none too subtle allusion to the fact that none of the guys in the band are spring chickens. But the way I actually came up with the name, my wife and I were walking up the sidewalk to our front door in December this past year, and there was one flower blooming in the midst of nothing. The leaves weren't up or anything. And I said, look, Mary, a winter rose. And then my mind said, wait, that's a name for something, you know. And so I went to the bed. I said, hey, look, never mind what we're going to call it. Let's call it winter rose. And they all said, hey, yeah. So that's where it came from.
Beautiful. So, gosh.
That inspiration.
Yeah.
And actually, like, due to the fact that the guys in the band are older than your average 25-year-old guy band, I asked if they wanted to call it the Grays. And they said, no, I should do that. And we kicked around the idea of putting up a poster that would say, see Winter Rose on their debut and possibly farewell tour. And when we were asked about it, if people would say, well, is it just a temporary band or something? No, but we're afraid we might die, you know. So, but nonetheless, we're all healthy guys, you know. It's not going to be farewell tour, but nonetheless, just having fun with them.
When the CD comes out, we definitely want to have you and the guys on the show because
we
want to help any way possible.
We want to do it.
This has been an absolutely fantastic show, Dr. Day.
I know. 90 minutes went by just like that.
Oh, my God. I can't believe it.
Well,
you don't realize, Rick, sometimes we trudge through these 9.
I can imagine. I've had interviews like that. We had an interview one time way back in the Brito days when I wasn't too well-versed in any of this stuff. And we went on the radio station, and the guy says, so, how do you like it here? And we went, oh, wait, this guy may not be too quick on the uptick. So he said, well, you know, we haven't been here very long, but we're wondering, are there some interviews? And we tried to lead him. And we said, are there any place we ought to see before we leave? And the guy says, yeah. And then he searched around for something else. So what are your favorite songs? And after about 15 minutes, Hillman got up and said, geez, what are we doing here? Play some music. And the guy goes, no, no. I mean, there have been some awful ones, so I understand entirely what you're talking about. I want to say this has been a great fun for me, too.
Oh, we're
and
so good.
I love telling stories. And by the way, my other plug I've got
to
get real fast is
I have a
book out, too.
Okay.
I have a book called Song Stories and Other Left-Handed Recollections, which is basically the thrust of the book is there's about 55 of my songs with a lyric and then a story, a relevant story, either what I wrote it about or something that happened or just something that's relevant, you know. And then there are 3 chapters of road stories because I love to tell stories. They're called Those Magic Moments, Parts 1, 2, and 3. And it's an e-book on Amazon right now. So it's easy to get.
Okay.
And,
well, if they're anything like the stories we've heard tonight, they are going to be bestsellers.
Yes,
There's some of the stories and like that. Anyway, like I said, I've had a very good time. Dr. Day and Larry, I had good fun, and it's been great talking to you and tell you some of these stories.
Thank you so
much. Well, we loved having you on, Rick, and our old friend Bobby Caldwell has said you need to have Rick on the program because he'd be a fantastic guest, and Bobby was not right. He's not wrong.
Bobby's pretty interesting himself, you know.
He is.
Yeah,
Bobby's been on a few times.
We figured we need to have you and Rodney Justo and Bobby on the show one night, and it will explode.
Free for all.
Well, you can invite me back anytime. I'll be glad to come.
Well, that's so nice to hear. Want to remind everyone, including Dr. Day, that next week on the program, brand new band, Rhodes Scholars, who formed a rock and roll band, the Thunder Pigs. They'll be on. So have a great week, everybody. Happy 4th of July. You've been listening to Wild World on Blog Talk Radio. Good night, everybody.
You guys say hello to the animals.
Thanks for listening this week to Larry Batson's Wild World. Be sure to join us again next week at 10 p.m. for more of the latest outdoor and wildlife news and information, along with great tales from your host, world-renowned wildlife expert, Mr. Larry Batson. Tune in again next week for another exciting edition of Larry Batson's Wild World. Larry Batson. Batson's Wild World is a Batson Wildlife Educational Services production in association